We usually read from your emails on Mondays. We're a day late because of the holiday. Last week, our discussion of war memoirs and blogs written by soldiers serving in Iraq and Afghanistan prompted Denise from Michigan to write, "My husband and I don't blog, but I have saved all of the instant message conversations we've shared since he left Michigan last Halloween. I don't know as they'll ever turn into a book, but it's interesting to go back and read them months after they've been saved." Margie from Cherry Hill, New Jersey, wrote in with a story from the pre-email era. As the daughter of an Army doctor who wrote a memoir of his experiences in the Pacific during the Second World War, I can testify to how valuable and special it is to have the document. I recently found a history book which quoted extensively from his memoir, which apparently ended up in the National Archives. Seeing my late father's name and words in print meant a lot to me. Last week, we also talked about President Bush's nomination of Harriet Myers to replace Sandra Day O'Connor on the Supreme Court. It sparked several questions we did not have time to get to, so NPR's political editor Ken Rudin is joining us here in Studio 3A. Sackcloth and ashes, Ken, to a black armband would have been sufficient to mourn the Yankees, don't you think?
I missed it. Did the Yankees lose?
They must have. Anyway, Mike Square from Mike Square from San Antonio, Texas, gets the first question, obviously inspired by the fact that Ms. Myers has never served as a judge. Please review the requirements for an appointment to the court. Most Americans, I think, don't realize that you do not need to have any legal experience whatsoever. Ken, are there specific job requirements?
You don't have to have any qualifications at all, given the fact you'd, like, obviously, to be president of the United States, you have to be 35 years old, you have to be a natural-born citizen, a resident of the United States for 14 years. To be a judge, there are no qualifications. Nothing is mentioned in the Constitution at all. Nothing about age, nothing about citizenship. You don't even have to be a judge, although, or even a lawyer, although everybody who's ever served on the court has been a lawyer.
Jonathan from San Carlos, California, has the next question. How many nominations to the Supreme Court have ever been voted down, and for what reasons have they not been confirmed?
Well, it's rare that it happens, but it's not completely uncommon. 12 in the history of the United States, 12 nominations have been rejected by the Senate. Another 7 or so has been withdrawn by the president. For example, in 1987, Robert Bork, President Reagan's nominee, was rejected by the Senate, a Democratic-controlled Senate, I should say, because he was just basically too conservative. It's not, you know, some people say that Harriet Myers doesn't have a paper trail. Well, Robert Bork had an extremely explicit paper trail outlining his ideology and things like that, and he was completely rejected by the Senate for that reason. Richard Nixon had back-to-back rejections in 1969 and 1970. 1969, Clement Haynsworth was rejected by the Senate because of financial conflict of interest charges. In 1970, his successor nominee was G. Harold Carswell, who basically had some very amazing statements on racial segregation in the past, and he was rejected by the Senate as well.
Let me follow up briefly on that. The Myers nomination, since the announcement last Monday, has run into a lot of skepticism from both right and left. Do you expect that she's in real trouble?
Well, you know, it's been a long time. It's been not since the 1950s has a conservative Republican opposed a Republican president's nominee to the Supreme Court. But you saw Sam Brownback of Kansas saying he's very unhappy about it earlier today on day-to-day, Robert Bork said that they're very, very disappointed with the Myers nomination. Again, you still have a Republican president. You still have a Republican Senate not wishing to inflict any further damage on the president, but it's very unusual to see conservatives bashing a conservative president on this.
Another listener email now. Why is Justice O'Connor alone referred to as a swing vote in any decision in which she is in the majority? Each justice has one equal vote. If any justice in a 5-4 decision were to have had a different opinion on a particular issue, the result would have changed, not only Justice O'Connor. As a comparison, I don't remember Justice Rehnquist being referred to as a swing vote in each of the 5-4 decisions in which he voted with the majority. So why is Justice O'Connor called the swing vote?
It has nothing to do with the Big Band era, I'll tell you that. But basically what it has to do is you don't know where O'Connor is going to stand on the issues. In other words, she's supported many liberal positions on for example, on racial preferences, displaying the Ten Commandments, on partial birth abortion, so-called partial birth abortion. She opposed a Nebraska law that banned it. So she basically voted the liberal position on those issues, whereas on other positions, on, for example, on school vouchers and gerrymandering, racial gerrymandering, she voted with conservatives. So even though Rehnquist has been in 5-4 decisions, basically you know, almost know, you can expect where Rehnquist is going in. O'Connor is a very unpredictable vote, and that's why she's considered that swing vote.
Ken Rudin, thanks very much. And you look very good with a rally monkey there. And Ken Rudin is NPR's political editor, and he also writes the Political Junkie column, which you can read at npr.org. And he joined us here in Studio 3A. If you have comments, questions, or for corrections for us, the best way to reach us is by email. The address is totn@npr.org. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Washington.